Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. This episode, I'm excited to be continuing the mini-series with my co-host, Laura Walker-Lee. If you don't know Laura, you should. She and I own the event series with my brother called Innovation and Leadership Live. And she is the CEO over at AG Capital Film Fund, coming out of her years at CAA. And is also, in the last few years, has really made a name for herself in venture and capital introductions and things both in the U.S. and internationally. Laura, I'm going to turn it over to you to introduce our fascinating guest.
Oh, thank you so much, Jess. In preparing for this interview, I just became increasingly convinced that Wolf embodies innovation and leadership in some of the most important ways. I'll read off his bio in a minute, but I met Wolf last year. Wolf and I are both part of the Fast Company Impact Council, and we look for ways to marry business enterprise and venture and things like that to better the world. And we were at a roundtable at the New York Stock Exchange, and we were in this brainstorm with a lot of industry leaders about how to help founders continue to raise capital, extend their runway, and also look for alternatives outside of raising capital by looking for grants and maybe taking on debt capital and really just getting back to the basics of actually focusing on your balance sheet instead of just focus on raising money all the time. And when that happened, Wolf just kind of lit up the room and everybody leaned in to Wolf's advice. And Wolf sits on many, many boards for obvious reasons. And so I'm just going to read a little bit of his bio here. So Wolf is a technology industry veteran with more than 25 years of experience leading enterprise business strategy and innovation. He joined East Bank Technologies in 2007, originally as CEO, and has managed the organic growth of the company, including scaling the team from 35 to more than 200 employees today. During his tenure, Wolf has also served as president of Epiphany, a division of East Bank Technologies, through its acquisition by Microsoft. Wolf's vision and customer-centric approach to digital transformation, leveraging data science and AI, is credited for helping establish East Bank Technologies as a leader delivering sophisticated customer solutions that enable customers to win in today's digital economy. So that's a very professional bio. I feel like the shortened version of what Wolf does is he is like the fixer for enterprise business. Huge corporations come to him, usually CIOs from companies, saying, "We have this problem. We've heard that you're the guy to assemble a team to fix our problem." And they're in a meeting the next day. And I think that one of the historical references that people use for Wolf is that he used to work at MicroStrategies as the worldwide
operations manager.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you were an early employee of MicroStrategy, and you grew the company with leadership, obviously, to 2,700 people very, very quickly. And then the world fell apart and a lot of people lost their jobs. And you had a decision to make. Do you give up or do you lean in?
That's right.
And you leaned in, and then several years later, MicroStrategies became the sixth most profitable company that was publicly traded.
That's right, yeah.
Which is an incredible story. And
that's where I lost all my hair.
So from there, did you start East Bank after that? And talk about the path to from there to East Bank. Mm-hmm. And why you started East Bank.
You got it. Well, thank you, first of all, for having me. I feel super honored. I'm already having fun, and we'll have a lot of fun until you just cut me off, because I can talk about this forever. So MicroStrategy, you know, when the bubble imploded, I was actually the person that had the spreadsheet of 2,000 names of 2,700 people that needed to leave the company ASAP. And we had, you know, slept in the office, worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So it was just so heartbreaking. And within 3 months, that needed to be executed or there wouldn't be any MicroStrategy. And so there was, you know, a handful of team members that said, "Should we just jump the ship?" And I'm a stubborn German. Thank you, Mom. I said, nope, I'm going to stay here until this thing either crashes or we're flying again. And, you know, a few years later, by that time, I had moved to New York City. That was one of the patches that needed to be fixed, and I helped fix it. I was so burned out. I literally missed the birth of my firstborn, Lucas. He's now 20 years old. And it was just, you know, such a regret. And so, but I knew that I'm, you know, I'm just passionate about what I do. And so the only solution for me is to just take a sabbatical. So I took a sabbatical for 6 months when I was lucky enough that Sienna, who's now 18, was born, and just focus on the kids, focus on, you know, the house, build a crib and all these little things. And during that time, it was the two co-founders of MicroStrategy, Michael Saylor and Sandro Bansal, who knew the shareholders of Eastbank Tech, who recommended to Anthony Lanier, the main shareholder, that they know this fixer-upper that has too much time on his hands, and they should just ask me to come down to Washington, D.C. for a week, take a look around this tiny company of 25 team members or so, and what kind of recommendations I would give. So I did that, and you know, the next day I was again back in New York City on my bike with Lucas on the child seat going to a public swimming pool. And my phone rings and Anthony's on the phone. He said, we thought through everything that you just said. Do you want to be the CEO? And I just couldn't fathom it. First of all, I was, you know, too young, too inexperienced, in the middle of my sabbatical. And so it took a few months. And then January 1st, the following year, they had finally convinced me to take a huge pay cut, but have a lot of fun. And this is 19 years later, and it came true.
Wow. What an amazing,
thank you,
amazing story. And I do, what I have learned from just reviewing your history is that there are core principles that seem to really drive your decisions.
Absolutely.
And you know, you missing Lucas's birth reminds me of that book, Essentialism. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever read Essentialism.
No.
I'm forgetting the author, but he also missed the birth of his first child because he was working so much. And
I almost teared up right now as I was recounting it, you know, so.
Yeah, and he was very successful by many, many accounts, and he just started to study essentialism and how I think he mentions that like only 10% of Warren Buffett's portfolio accounts for 90% of his wealth, and there's all, you know, all these other examples that just show that success is so much not what you say yes to, but a lot of what you say no.
Absolutely.
To, and just getting really focused. So. Anyway, Jess, I'm sure you have maybe some questions from that introduction. Do you have any right now, or should I keep going?
Okay. You're on the spot.
So Eastbank. So Eastbank, in layman's terms, because you know our audience is not really engineers; it's more like, you know, corporate leaders and things like that, and thought leaders. It really seems like Eastbank focuses on enterprise technologies that are really ubiquitous, that the consumer doesn't even realize
yes.
they're using. They get plugged into companies like Microsoft or Capital One
yes.
or Kroger or the New York Stock Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to kind of hear about how Eastbank came into those opportunities and what maybe what the issue was and how you went about solving
yes.
it.
So first of all, you know, nobody's ever perfect. I can't say that I'm perfect or Eastbank Tech is perfect or anything like this. All you can do is iterate. You know, you start at some level and you start an iteration process. Every week, accomplish something or fail at something and then measure, you know, the gap between where were you and where are you, and try to do that on the smallest possible scale. And then if you're lucky, you keep the rate of change constant, because what happens is you're creating a hockey stick. If you're one of the, you know, very, very, very lucky ones, you increase the rate of positive change at every iteration, and then you just hyperscale. So we're not hyperscaling, but we started somewhere literally 18 years ago or 19 years ago when I joined, and I realized, so why did I join? I interviewed the existing customer base. We were just one of those service companies. And every CTO, every deputy CTO told me, you know, the team may not dress appropriately. They may forget to shave or whatever, but they have no delivery issues. And one after another told me this. And I said, this is what a marketing statement. And it comes from them. So why don't I hone in on that? And, you know, first was, if this team really is this great, I cannot afford to lose this team. So the, you know, one of the actions I took when I was CEO, and now I'm chairman, we have Philippe as the CEO, but one of the first actions was everything has to relate to employee turnover. It cannot be that I lose such a team with my experiments. And so the company-wide policy at the time was everyone gets full bonus if employee turnover is less than 1% per year, and everyone gets no bonus if it's more than 1% per year. And it seeped into the DNA of the company, you know? And so now, even to this very, we don't have that anymore. That was extreme, but I needed to get this into the DNA, you know? And now we live and breathe it. And as we add team members, we're so selective on culture, on capabilities, on skills, on experience, and versatility, because the technology world changes all the time. So thinking about Victor, the CTO, you know, he's a young man still to this very day, even though he has gray hair. But he started as a junior engineer using Microsoft technologies. Then he broke a dogma and he became a Java engineer, open source technologies, anti-Microsoft. And then he switched religions again and went into analytics. And then another one of his, you know, conversions into mobile technologies, cloud technologies. And on it goes. And I think that is the superpower that East Bank Tech, you know, brings, embodied in somebody like Victor, but it's throughout the entire company. And we stick together through thick and thin. And I think that's why over time, as we iterated, these enterprises have gotten to know us as the fixer-uppers. You know, the nicknames that we get are digital marines, the digital SWAT teams, the digital firefighters. And it just has become a theme. And, you know, if you look at our marketing budget, it's laughable, but word spreads from, you know, happy customers where we innovated with them. The key is with them, not we innovate for them. We teach them how to innovate so that they then turn into innovation machines themselves. And we literally, our job is to replace ourselves with their team members. And another nickname that we got from Shailesh Prakash, the CIO of the Washington Post, he called us his jump partner. So every time there's a jump, they jumped with us. But we taught them throughout the jump on how to keep running without us. And the next jump comes. Like I said, technology moves so fast, indefinitely, that there's always a need for a jump once you start this iteration process together with the customer and also internally. So That's what we do. And along the way, I'm famous for long questions to short answers to kind of provide context and how I think about this stuff. Along the way, we then also have no choice, but we have to innovate ourselves. So we create software intellectual property for these customers, turning them into software companies, which means we also have to necessarily innovate ourselves and create our own software intellectual property while staying, you know, the digital marines that provide a top-notch quality service, which is where we learn what to innovate for ourselves.
That's amazing. You know, to touch on your Washington Post example, so I read that Fast Company famously described the Washington Post, after you worked with the CIO, as the software company that happens to have a newsroom. And then did that methodology the way that you were working with the Washington Post spread to other publications as well?
They tried. So some of them tried. And I remember sitting in one of those, I always establish quarterly meetings. So a key for somebody like me is also to just get out of the way, let the techies geek tech, but you know, always check in on a quarterly basis with the CIO, CTO, CEO, whatever it is, and so that we catch yellow flags before they turn red flags and we can keep everything in green. So in one of those quarterly meetings, Shailesh told me that his competitors in the media industry had tried to replicate what we did together. I cannot say that we did it. Like I said, we innovate with them. And they called him to ask if they can just license the software. So that's how he turned into a software product company that happens to have a newsroom full of reporters, not he, the Washington Post, before Jeff Bezos bought them. And now there's all these publications that are powered by the software of the Washington Post. There are some that have, you know, attempted it. I'm not aware of anybody doing it the way the Post did it.
Mm-hmm. It's such a great case study and also an example of how you're kind of, we were talking yesterday about your theory of being a chief translation officer. For CEOs and leadership to be thinking about how technology can be interlaced into maybe their brick and mortar business or their business that doesn't necessarily seem like a tech company, but tech has really integrated horizontally
Yes.
across so many different verticals. And so it seems like you are pinpointing the opportunities for those leaders as they're trying to iterate with AI and with cloud computing or with, you know, all the other very complicated things
right.
that you deal with that I don't necessarily understand, but really exciting stuff.
So at this intersection between these verticals where mm-hmm. IT or technology is as a vertical has gone horizontal, at these intersections sit the category killers of each of those verticals. And so that's what I try to hone every CEO in to understand. If you know, think about this intersection between technology and your traditional legacy business, this is where your future lies. And if you don't latch onto it, somebody else will. And you will not die, maybe. You might die a slow death or you will just stay the way you are, but you're missing an amazing opportunity. And these technologies now are so available and so ubiquitous that with a translation officer like me and the East Bank Tech team as a whole, we can translate the CEO's, you know, company into that category killer.
Wow. That's great. I have one more question, then I'm going to turn it over to Jess. Mm-hmm. The attrition rate at your company is very striking.
Mm-hmm.
It's so low.
Yes.
And obviously people were motivated in the early days to stay because of the bonus structure. Who wouldn't tough it out and stay? But it's no longer implemented. I would love to know, there's one thing that I read about you, which was that you really fight for your engineers, and that if they have a software that's not being utilized at the company that you've implemented it, you will figure out a way for it to exist in the world. And so I'm sure that's a huge contributor, especially with the engineers, because there's a sense of actual purpose because they know that through you that you will find a way to get their software into the world. But what other aspects of your thought leadership or the culture at the company keeps people in place?
So, you know, there's always somebody that will pay more money than I will. It's just a fact. And so that is a thankless race to get into. So you have to think about other aspects of your life that you need to take care of. So the most straightforward one is that you have to be, I am a capitalist at heart, no doubt. That's why I came into this country. The, you know, heaven of capitalism is right here, and that's why I'm here. But you have to be a social capitalist or a capitalist socialist inside of your enterprise or corporation or organization. That means you always have to try to find the best possible benefits that you can provide to the employees, to the team members, until you just run out of options, so that they have nothing to worry about. You include their families and all family members into the benefit system so that they have the freedom of mind and the peace of mind to just focus on what they do best And that is great, create great software. And that doesn't mean slave yourself away 8 hours a day, 12 hours a day. Literally, this could mean 1 second of brilliance. You know, great software isn't lots of software. Great software is great software. And that can be, I remember when Microsoft sent the due diligence team to our company to acquire one of our products. And they came with a team of 6 techies because they expected to read lots of software code and they expected to be here for a week. They were done after the first day, they ran out of software to read. So elegant software and impactful software, you know, sometimes is really short, which translates into, I don't need the team to kill themselves burning hours. I need them to be brilliant. And so that should define everything around it. That then also, so this benefits is the easy one. Everyone will, you know, eventually remember that and hopefully enact it for humanity, really. But the other part then, and the much more difficult thing to do is culture. So you really have to think through your culture, know who you are, who you want to be, why you want to be that. And you also shouldn't be afraid to, like you said, take some really tough decisions. So when, you know, over the course of the years, I fired customers in dire situations when really we needed the cash flow, but it was the right thing to do in order to protect my team members. And so, you know, you when push comes to shove, employees, team members have to be priority number one, even if this means, you know, we have to sacrifice on the monetary aspects or whatever it may be. And then at the same time, we're innovators. Our tagline is innovation as a service. So I need to allow the team, this is an additional aspect, maybe part of culture, but really more part of the business plan. The business plan has to reflect that if you have innovators as your team members all around you, then you need to create a path for them to innovate, because these innovators, you know, software engineers, I describe it in one of the chapters of a book I wrote, they long for an endorphin shot. And this endorphin shot has to come at the end of the day, at the end of a sprint. It means that your software gets deployed into a production system with real users. You alluded to that. I go to great lengths to make sure that the customers deploy the software so that it is in the wild, has an impact, can be measured. And the path then also has to include that you allow them the freedom to innovate themselves. So, you know, some more staid companies, and it may sound arrogant to say it this way, but Google has this 20% rule and institutionalized it that way. To me, that's, and sorry, Google, I don't mean to offend. It's great. Obviously, you're much bigger than me. But it is more like a bureaucratic demand of innovation. When I want this to be part of, you know, what of the day-to-day culture, that somebody comes up with a great idea and gets to implement it. And sometimes you don't have an idea for years and years and years, even if I force them to spend 20% of their week on innovation, you can't force it. It has to come organically. But once it happens, we have the resources. We, you know, we create repeatable solutions on our own dime. We introduce them to the marketplace, we harden them over time, we create a business plan around it that rewards the innovator for having had this groundbreaking idea. And they get, of course, a share of the winnings, profit share, or in case of an exit, they get a great share of that. And I think it's important that we do that as a company if we really claim that we're employee first and innovator first, that all has to be part of it, and many, you know, smaller aspects of it too.
Wow. I feel like we could do a whole other podcast just on encouraging brilliance in a burnout culture. I mean, so many articles are written and commentary about how workers are burned out, yes, and, you know, there's quiet quitting and things like, yes, that. And you've been, you know, really solving,
I'm just lucky,
against that. Yeah. In your practices. Jess, I don't want to hog this interview. Please jump in.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about our conversation from yesterday, and I'm like obsessed these days with kind of the venture opportunity in longevity and kind of this creation of what Stanford University thinks is going to be a $20 trillion new industry, right? And we've been thinking so much about kind of an AI-enabled media company of kind of like where we're, you know, the, you know, we've been trying to think like, what would it take to be the top source on longevity biotech news for finance in the world? Like, what would that take? And so I'm fascinated to hear more about this Washington Post story. Can you explain this concept of a software company that happens to own a newsroom?
Sure. It applies everywhere. It's not just in media. It literally applies in every vertical. You could pick Volvo, Mercedes-Benz, you name it. They all have to think about this. I'm convinced. And like I said, I'm not perfect. So maybe I'm, you know, the data points lead me to believe that we've created, lead me to believe that this is the truth. So if that is true, it doesn't mean that you have to stop licensing software from Microsoft and Oracle or go into the Google Cloud or you name it. None of that. You have to take advantage of those. But what you have to do is you have to be very sincere in examining the core of what you do. So in the case of the Washington Post, that is a content management system. They produce content and they distribute content and the content gets managed. That is what you have to own. You can't license your core. It's the heart of what you do. You cannot license that out to somebody else. You will always be beholden to somebody else's decisions that affect what you do in the core. So, and there are many examples. If you're a hospital group and you license out your electronic medical record system, if that is the core of what you do, I don't know, CEOs would know. But is that the core of what you do from a systematic perspective as a system? Then you need to own it. You can't give your digital destiny out to somebody else to control. And so in the case of the Washington Post, they licensed a content management system, but then also you don't just suddenly turn it off and you hope for the best and you build something from scratch. It's hugely risky. And that's where, you know, talking about ventures and startups, that's where so many of them die. I've had 8 exits, haven't had a failure yet. And that may not be true forever, but one of the reasons why I think is that you innovate around the core with a revenue stream attached immediately to it, and you use that revenue stream to finance the conversion while leaving the existing system in place. And so that means in practicality that you leave the core system, but you build new tiny pieces of software financed by the revenue that they can generate to do something that the core of what you do cannot do, or that can do something better than what the core of what you do is doing today. And so over time, as you just get on this journey, it's again, iterations, one module, one iteration at a time, maybe $50,000 a pop, 2 months of work. Nobody's going to, you know, risk their job or their professional future for something like that. Over these iterations, one module at a time, $50,000 a pop every 2 months, you suddenly have this thing surrounded and you have started owning your core. And I remember, you know, one day in one of those quarterly meetings, Shailesh said, guess what? We just turned the damn thing off because these modules had taken over and they controlled them and they had taken ownership of their digital destiny and became a software product company that happens to have a newsroom full of reporters. I have many examples like this, not just the Post.
So I want to dig deeper on this. In a situation like that, you know, the question, the way we frame the question so often leads us in one direction or another for an answer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this idea of like people who would frame the question, what's our core? Our core is good reporting. We've got the stories that others don't have. And so then if they ask the question, okay, how do we double down on that core instead of like as you defined it, where the core is not content creation, it's content creation and distribution, which obviously leads to a much different answer. When you think about helping, you know, we have a lot of founders that listen, investment fund managers that listen to the show. when you think about helping innovators, I don't know, like challenge what they've been saying the core is, or like helping them get to places of deep honesty and insight about what the core should and shouldn't include. And, you know, like the Washington Post probably didn't necessarily need to build their own software for payroll. You know, like they could probably choose somebody else's for payroll. That's not this core.
They should. Right? 100%.
And so this idea of like, what is our core? What isn't our core? Any help on that decision tree?
So you can get stuck in this type of analysis forever. Paralysis by analysis. So at one point, you just have to, first of all, be prepared that you're wrong. There might be multiple cores. Laura mentioned a company called Kroger. That's a grocery chain, a very large one. And I assume that there's multiple cores in a sophisticated business like that. A core could be the supply chain management system. It could be, the store management system. And so you're probably talking about a few cores. The more you abstract towards a sophisticated enterprise. And so at one point, you just have to make a decision. So time box yourself, no more than 4 weeks, and say, after 4 weeks, I will decide on my first core. And then you start iterating. And you might prove to be wrong. That's why this iteration is so important, that after an iteration, you can course correct. And you can say, that I just wasted my $50,000. Thank God I only wasted $50,000. Next core. And again, you know, theme of iteration, you might inevitably find your core. You might actually identify that your category killer is a multitude of cores that you have to, you know, separate, unify, and own. Did that make sense?
It does. And I think I really love your example of building up small and small and small and small until it's strong.
Yes.
Maybe one last question before I hand it back to Laura. Thinking about artificial intelligence and like in our case, let's say we invest in some biotech company who, you know, they have all these very smart PhDs and they've done all this science research, but it becomes obvious that embracing an AI mindset could help them do more faster. So assuming you've got the right kind of intelligence of folks, but they don't have the background, what's a tip you have for CEOs listening today on helping become an AI first organization and not just have like the one AI specialist in the corner?
Yes. So first of all, AI, you know, is one of my pet peeves these days, and not just because of OpenAI. I've been in that world, the big data world, and my entire professional career. I'm a data guy, if you boil it down to what I've done my entire life. And so what I always first remind every CEO, and I did that last week in Atlanta and yesterday to two other major organizations, I always remind these C-level executives that Germans wanted to call AI complex data processing. So artificial intelligence, the opaqueness of it, the confusion of it, let's pop that right away. It's not artificial, it's not intelligent, it's complex data processing. So now it almost is self-explanatory already. You are dealing with complex data, obviously in the field that you just mentioned, you're dealing with complex data. You need to find a way to process that data. How do you do that? It's two other factors. So we just mentioned data. You need incredible compute power in order to find patterns in this complex data. That's what these machines do. But it's not the computer that does it, or, you know, not the compute power that does it. That is done by mathematics. So data, compute power, plus mathematics, and you have your artificial intelligence. So the way to go about this is, don't try to replicate these massive computer networks that are out there already. You have to build from day one a cloud first type of thinking into your roadmap. That doesn't mean you don't have your own computer anymore. It should be connected somehow, but cloud first. Make sure that you stay as native and cloud agnostic as possible, so that you have the power to switch. Right now, Microsoft is the clear leader in AI, I think. As of yesterday, maybe today Google already took over again, and maybe tomorrow AWS will. So make sure that you don't lock yourself in thinking that you've bet your horse on or that your ticket on the winner today, that this winner will be the winner, tomorrow. So make sure you're flexible in your architecture, software architecture about this. And then be as tiny as you possibly can. This big data thing is, big BS. And it means you need good data. That's what you need to train your mathematics with. Find good, complex data in order to feed it into the compute so that the mathematics can make a prediction out of it. All of AI is nothing else than predictions. Those generative image generators, Sora that was recently released by OpenAI, they all just do predictions on top of structured data, unstructured data, combination of the two of them, but they predict something. So it means that you're dealing with probabilities. You don't deal with certainty. Certainty is deterministic engineering in our world. This is probabilistic engineering. They might be wrong. Sometimes being wrong is actually really great, and we call them hallucinations. Again, this is not some artificial intelligent being suddenly falling into some hallucination thing, right? They're just predicting incorrectly. 5% likelihood that my cup of tea is empty. Well, it's actually full. Well, your prediction was incorrect, but at least you got it, you got 95% wrong and, or 5% wrong and 95% correct. So
fascinating.
That's how I think about this.
Laura, what kind of questions does this bring up for you?
Well, I really like listening to you talk, Wolf, because I'm really seeing that you're breaking down complex issues through mental models and you're, applying that. I mean, you've worked with the New York Stock Exchange, Kroger, Washington Post. I mean, those are very different businesses. But it just seems like your mental models start to easily break down the issues. And so it's been really good listening to you. I have two questions. One is a follow-up on AI. So you and I were talking a few weeks ago about AI and adoption to it. And I was telling you that I have a curiosity and a concern when it comes to the entertainment industry.
Yes.
About AI, because I'm seeing creatives who are locked up in union negotiations that take months and they're not earning money doing that. And AI is just a tsunami wave that will land on the shore.
Yes.
And take over.
Yes.
A lot of jobs. And I think it's really important that creatives embrace AI in a way that will enhance their own creativity.
Very much.
That I'm not seeing them do.
Yes.
One example is I'll get sent screenplays from writers or writer directors. And if they're a writer director, 10 years ago, I would have had to ascertain whether or not they could execute on the vision they were describing, just based on like a sixth sense,
mm-hmm.
and maybe like a paper deck that they had given me, mm-hmm. or certain visual references from other movies that had already been made.
Mm-hmm.
But now they can use Midjourney,
yeah.
very quickly, to show me how they are planning on executing.
I know.
On a much larger level at millions of dollars.
Yes.
For nothing, for zero
yes.
dollars, And you would be shocked at when I get a screenplay from a writer director and I say, I'd really love to see how your execution would be, like use Midjourney or use a different AI platform to come back to me with a small demo of maybe this scene or how would you execute this? And so often the creatives don't come back to me.
I feel
like it's just, yeah. So that's a frustration I have with my industry. I'm wondering for you, since you've worked across so many verticals, and I don't think there's any right answer here, but what is your outlook on leadership that does not adapt AI into their business?
Gosh, I'm going to use some very drastic words for this because okay. I passionately feel it. You're facing digital Darwinism. One of my friends coined that term. you're facing digital Darwinism, where if you don't embrace this, you will go the way of the dinosaurs, inevitably. It might not be, you know, one strike, but over time, you will go into extinction. Remember that not every dinosaur died. We have turtles, birds are dinosaurs, crocodiles, and so on. So those were the ones that were lucky, maybe, but I think they adapted. They adapted, and you have to adapt. And at the same time, this kind of a wave sets free species that were, you know, under the hoof of the previous dominators. Mammals started springing up, taking over the green savannas. Yoo-hoo, no more T-Rex to eat me. The same thing is going to happen with this. And so what is the key of survival in this wave? And I recently posted on LinkedIn an article that I really like from Oxford University. They coined it the third transformational event in human history is this wave of AI. First one is, the farming revolution, industrial revolution. Internet, no, it's the AI revolution, the third transformational event in human history. So what is the key not to miss the boat on this? The key is to have ideas. These things, we have to keep them. They're not artificial. They're not intelligent. They don't have ideas. Only we have ideas, but they will accelerate our ideas. So if you don't have ideas, this is probably not for you. But in your industry that you just described, ideas are everywhere. And so it is imperative, paramount to embrace it, play with it, do it for your own educational purposes. Think of ways of how to use it for certain processes. So AI is extremely powerful once you attach it to a process, the process of script writing, the process of creating a manual, the process of creating a painting. It accelerates these things. So our own, you know, we have a tiny design team in Lisbon, Portugal, and they are artists, really. And, you know, there's hesitation in the beginning of embracing it, but today, they're using AI every single day to run their ideas through and get, instead of, you know, one illustration done or one design done at the end of the day, they can now produce thousands of them. And so then, does this take your job away? No, it accelerates your job. It enhances your ideas. It allows you at the end of the day to go through a portfolio of 1,000 designs, say, nah, nah, nah. Oh my God, I could not have come up with this. What I always remember, sorry for babbling again. What I always remember is Google Go beat the reigning Go world champion at the time, long time ago in my world. But what did it do? So yes, he lost, the human, but he came up with the famous move 37, I believe, move 37 during one of the games. It's called the God move. It is absolute brilliance. And it's the AI that made the Go world champion come up with something where everyone in the room just gasped, had never seen it before. So the AI creates brilliance in humans that we can't even think about. But we have the idea. The machine didn't come up with that. We are the creatives. We are the creatives.
Sorry, I get so passionate about this.
I love your language.
Thank you.
I love your language around this, and I feel like you're almost like, you know, a de-influencer when it comes to AI. You're taking away what some of the assumptions are about it creating ideas and being its own entity, and just, you know, really breaking it down for people.
It's just math.
It's really just meant to enhance.
Yes.
What you're already doing.
Absolutely.
You're inspiring me to have a date with AI once a week. I'm going to put that in my
Take
calendar.
Me along. That'd be fun.
Yeah.
And Jess, come along.
I have one more question, then maybe Jess can take us home with whatever he's curious about. Is there a particular vertical that you've not worked in before that you would really love to, or a problem that you would love to solve for?
A problem I would love to solve for is... Gosh, I should have patented it before mentioning it so that I can defend it. So
Well, we could have another interview later then.
So the equivalent of what we did at MicroStrategy does not exist in artificial intelligence, and I can only explain it technically. So I'm not going to do that, but for the sake of, you know, you not losing your listeners, but that equivalent does not exist yet. I would love to build it, because even MicroStrategy was a missed opportunity in our space back then. I can only imagine the addressable market and the fun we would have doing this in the generative AI world. So that's the one I would love to build. I would work myself to death for that. The one vertical I have literally never worked with is Hollywood, the studios. And I don't even know how to describe that industry, you know? I don't know what's going on in that industry. So I'm very curious. Maybe work with somebody like Disney, or, you know these names better than me. I don't. I'm very curious.
I did not know that was going to be your answer, but I am happy to tackle that with you. I'm very motivated to make that happen.
I just went through all the existing verticals. So oil and gas, check, 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 all of them. Automotive, Mercedes-Benz, check. Finance, all kinds of banks and venture capitalists, private equity companies, retail, media. I can't think of another vertical that I haven't touched. Healthcare, we revolutionized healthcare. We turned a service company into a software company that happens to provide healthcare, you know, advice and data. Just amazing stories. Yours? I'm missing.
Okay, well, follow-up call very soon, later this week.
No problem.
Jess, do you want to take us home in the last few minutes we've got here with Wolf?
Yeah, well, to begin with, Wolf, will you tell people the company website and where to find you on social and all those kind of things?
So the company website is eastbanktech.com, and bank with a C. Fun story. Because if you have a K in there, you need a banking license. So we're not a bank. We had to put a C in there. eastbanktech.com. I have a very unique name to find on LinkedIn. I'm pretty sure I'm the only one. Wolf Ruzicka, Ruzicka. And my phone number is? No.
Yeah, that's great. So maybe to bring us home, I would just say this. What's one of the best pieces of advice you ever received?
That I ever received I have to think back to my mom and dad. Try it. So, you know, there's an article out there on the internet that calls me the citizen of the world. I grew up in a tiny town in Germany, in my little bubble, comfortable life as an only child. Whatever I thought of, I got. And I always dreamed, you know, of the map, the global map. And so literally my parents at one point said, just try it. So I was 13 and I went all by myself to Peru, South America, to go to high school with an exchange family and so on. I was a changed person afterwards and never stopped ever since. And so it's just try it. You know, everyone has their own comfort zone to some degree. Make it a point every single day, like I'm doing right now. This is not my comfort zone, being interviewed by two highly intelligent, very eloquent people. But, you know, every day, try to find something that is uncomfortable for you without losing your comfort zone. Make it a point to do it every week, every year, every month, but do it regularly. Just try it.
So maybe my final question here and follow-up is, for people who are feeling burned out, overscheduled, and things like this, any thoughts on or advice on how to cut out the less effective things in our lives so we have the time to try it?
So that emerged, you know, my life is just such a string of anecdotes. When the world fell apart at MicroStrategy, and there were literally just a handful of people that committed, others were, you know, in shock, couldn't move. And others had to leave or left. And there was just too much to do for the few of us that really wanted to make a difference. And so my boss and mentor at the time, Eduardo Sanchez, he and I, we sat opposite of each other. You have to remember, every single dollar that the company made went through our hands. So we knew we had the most crucial job to rescue a dying company. And so he taught me that every single day, you can really only do 8 big things. Write them down and try to accomplish them. There will be so many distractions throughout the day, but those 8, you have to do your very best to accomplish them. You may not be able to do it every day, but then you pick that big bucket and put it right on top. And we literally wrote them down, you know, in our notebooks. Priority number 1, 2, 3, 4, 8. Couldn't get to 8. That becomes priority number 1 for tomorrow, and only 8. And then it sorts itself out. At the end of every week, we had this amazing practice of just deleting every email in our inbox. Just delete it. If you couldn't get to it by then, it's probably already too old. And people know our cell phone number. So if it were urgent, they would have called us anyway. And those phones were ringing all the time. So that's how I prioritize to this very day. You know, you're one of my top 8 priorities today. And I take it seriously. And I won't pick up the phone.
That's so great. Well, listen, we really appreciate you taking time with us here today. It's been super fun.
I'm very grateful to both of you for inviting me. Thank you.
You bet.